Okay. All right. Let me just take my phone off vibrate because then you'll hear that the whole class every time it's a notification. Okay, welcome everyone. So we have a fun topic for this week. I mean, it's we always try to do fun topics. Ah, welcome Arlene, welcome Lloyd. How you guys doing? Okay. You're welcome to take a sheet if you want. I didn't have time to do translations, you'll forgive me. But you know. It's 7:02, but I was literally just starting. You guys right in the nick of time. And look at all these seats here in person that are open for you. You can spread yourself out. It's very good. And we're joined so with Lloyd and Arlene in person. So it looks like we have Zadie, Audrey, Jake, Susan, and Arthur on the Zoom, and I'm sure more will join. So as I said, we have a fun topic. You remember the past 2 weeks? Oh, welcome, Dina. Okay, good. Oh, we have a Z1 here. Very good. Well, not really a Z1, two men, two women. But you know, if we were very progressive, it would be. But anyway, you know, by the way, why men and women don't mix for a Z1, right?
Why?
You know, the reason it's given is because men and women aren't supposed to be eating together to begin with. That's the argument that some make. I think there was a more left-wing fellow who wrote an article in one of these journals where he kind of goes exhaustively through all the sources on Zeman and makes the argument for why maybe men and women could mix together today. Mind you, it's already, oh, welcome Toby. Oh, look at everyone in person here.
We have a female demon.
You have a, well, oh, so that's the controversy, which is you have like what we have here, Lloyd and myself, and then three women. Do the three women make a Zeman? And it seems, at least halacha in our communities, is that yes, they do.
Our community, we say it
Uh, I mean, the mono-Orthodox community.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think we're mono-Orthodox, right?
I didn't know what
Yeah,
if they weren't going to allow men and women to eat together, then there'd be an awful lot of split families.
so it's interesting. I remember when I was when I learned in Eretz Yisrael, so we went to Me'a Sharim for Shabbos. And the men were all in the main room, and the women were huddled in the kitchen because there was an overflow. And I think, like in some very extreme right-wing sects, that's what they do. In the normal yeshivish world, men and women are at the table together. They might put like the women on like one and the men on the other, but like they don't do separate
Families,
tables.
they don't really.
Yeah, families they don't.
Yeah,
Families
they
they
have
don't.
guests.
I don't know. They had separate rooms at my cousin's wedding, and her great aunt was very upset. She said, "I want to sit with my husband."
Oh, right. Oh, Lloyd, you
And then,
mentioned
and then,
there,
and at my
Susan.
cousin's Lubavitch wedding, her sister said, "They're splitting my family to make another family."
It's interesting. It's actually, there's a good amount of halachic literature on that very question of separate seating at a wedding. And I don't just mean at the chuppah, but I mean at the meal itself. So, 3 years ago, I
The
guess,
couple was hardly
when I
separate.
started working as the rabbinic intern at the Yangi Yisrael Plainview, it was literally my first Shabbos there was my Shabbos Sheva Brachos right after Marissa and I got married. So I decided what would my debut shiur at the shul be on? It would be on the topic of mixed seating at weddings because Marissa's family was, you know, just a average mono-Orthodox family like you would have over here. It wasn't even a havamina, you know, like a thought to have mixed a separate seating. My family, they have to do like the rabbi's table, which is only men. Like it's rabbi's table, it's only men, but because they don't want to have any women at the table. Some people dafka wanted separate seating. For other people from their community, it's like a whole novelty. Like I can actually sit with my wife. And other people are like, oh, I have to sit with my wife. You know, so there's different opinions over here. But there's a good halakhic literature on it. And one of the arguments, I think it's Rev Henkin who says, it's so silly. We have all these boys and girls who don't get to meet each other. And, you know, we always complain they shouldn't meet each other in a, you know, in a licentious or promiscuous way. Here you have a wedding where people are being married. Chadasu chadin. This is a holy atmosphere. If there's one place where they should be mixed together and meeting, it should be right over here. I mean, think of all the superstition that's around also
Definitely.
that we need that. But from that
Good,
point of
good,
view,
good, good, good
so
thought.
right. So I forgot it was Rav Henkin from Nachum Rabinovich, which was one of the mono-Orthodox ones. But it's that you know we'll do that at God willing as a shiur. It's in the files somewhere. I'm happy to bring that out when I guess if anyone
We
wants
have a
me to,
wedding.
yeah. If you want me to speak at any wedding, so Rosh Hashanah,
For me, it's the quality of the food.
Very good, very good. You know, I have a lot to share about weddings in terms of my preferences, but we actually, so how do we get into this? Because the past 2 weeks, we're talking about kiddushin, kiddushin toast, where maybe you get married under false pretenses, and we talked about how to permit someone to save kids from becoming mamzerim. Just happens to be, I like to pretend that I planned this all out. But let's call that shkaka pratis, that God planned it out. What is the controversial, what's the story that everybody skips when they're little kids in this week's Parsha? Very good. Look at the sheet. You done, Tamar. So I remember when I was a kid.
We go so early before that, Noah. Lots of things you see.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of things.
But like, Sarah's taken.
But I mean, there are things that we sugarcoat or we like gloss. But I remember Yehuda and Tamar, like wholesale, we just skipped. Like, I didn't know. You know, like, you know, you learn about Lot and his daughters. So, like, we were told, like, oh, you know, they had a baby together or something. But they did it in, like, very general terms. But here, like, they wholesale just skipped the entire thing. So one day I remember when I was in middle school, the Rosh Yeshiva always gave a shmooze on Fridays, which a shmooze is kind of like – the Rosh Hashanah just talks about whatever he wants. Like, it gets somehow connected to the Parsha. But imagine, like, a rabbi sermon, but not as not organized and going for, like, 40 minutes. So that's what a shmooze is. So we need things to entertain ourselves. And I wasn't as smart as I've become, thank God, where I know to come with reading material and articles to read. So all I had in front of me was an art scroll stone chumash like you have in the shul. Do you want to cover your hands with a coat or something?
All of a sudden reading.
So I remember I was like, just flipping. I'm like, all right, may as well read about the Parsha and get some, you know. So I'm reading through the Parsha and I get to this section. You know, Tamar, like, this is in the Chumash? What? Nowadays, I would imagine at a normal modern Orthodox school, they teach the story at the very least, even if they have to gloss
it. Depends how early they teach it.
That's how early.
Yeah.
I guess the argument is that you're not teaching everything anyway. You're kind of like selecting highlights from the Parsha. So you can kind of be judicious about which ones you want to share, which ones not. But this gets into that article I share with you from the Punim Journal. Okay, but anyway, that's the story. So the big there's a number of questions over here. So remember we talked about one of the issues if a man and woman are not married? Well, if they're not, remember we asked the question, well, if we want to avoid mamzerim altogether, how about this man and woman, they just live together, but they don't be married? Why is that something that we can't conscious that they wouldn't be married to each other? What's problematic? The problem is as follows. So those who want to follow along inside, the first paragraph. For Amdu Bezera Busavir Parsha Zoom. Okay, so many people, much ink has been spilled over explaining this Parsha. So remember, a little bit of background about the story. Yehuda's first son gets married to Tamar. Excuse me. Then he dies. Then the second son gets married to her. He dies as well. Yehuda's left with one son left. He's like, there's something wrong with this woman. Okay, I'm not going to let my third son die. And there's actually this, it's called the Katlanis, which is a woman who kind of has a track record, like a preschooler, a black widow, that anyone who she's with dies. So she might have some sort of, she might have something. I should be careful.
quick succession.
What was that? Okay.
That quick succession.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So the issue.
God forbid.
Yes, God forbid. So it's as follows. So this is the issue. The Lusar B'Torah Parshas Kedoshim will see a Kedeshim of Nos Yisrael. It says that a woman should not become a Kedesha, which is
a prostitute.
Very good. But you know, remember we learned how like we translate Mamzer as a bastard, but it's not a prop. That doesn't really capture what the term means in Halacha. Similarly, over here, a prostitute. A Kedesha doesn't really translate well as a prostitute because what's a prostitute? It's a woman who gets money for hire and has sexual relations with people. But, you know, you wouldn't think of a boyfriend, girlfriend living together as prostitution. But from a Torah perspective, that's not what a Kedesha is. Kedesha is the Choha Boel Isha below Kedushin, any relationship that takes place outside the context of marriage. Hareza over belavdlosia kedesha. One violates the isser of kedesha. So you know you hear from Christians all the time about sinning outside the context of marriage, and it's not just a Christian concept, but losia kedesha actually is that idea that a man and woman who aren't halachically married, they are violating the Isser of Osiyah Kedesha each time they are together. Boven de lefi zed, sarach ian. So we have a question now. This is our question with this premise. Heyach ba Yehuda al Tamar. How did Yehuda decide to have relations with Tamar? Hello, Yeshba ze Isser Losiyah Kedesha. No. I mean, she actually was pretending to be a prostitute, but this violates the Isler of Losia Kedesha. And now you might ask, wait, hold up one second. The Torah wasn't yet given. As Tosul Kulin points out, they try to keep the Torah when they can. So the question is, why would Yehuda, who is this great tzaddik, decide to have relations with Tamar, which was outside the marriage? Now, one solution that could be given is that maybe this is a pseudo form of Yibam. There is an argument to make that this is a pseudo form of Yibam. Now, you're going to ask me, well, first let me tell you what Yibam is, and I'll tell you why it's a bit of a difficult claim to swallow. Yibam is when a man passes away and leaves a wife in the world, they didn't have any children. There's a mitzvah for his brother to take his place and to have a child with his former wife. Now, the issue here is that Yehuda is the father. He's not the brother of the deceased. So he wouldn't have a mitzvah of Yibam. But some try to make that claim that it was a form of Yibam. And in fact, because maybe it was legitimized that way, who comes from this union ultimately? Which great figure in Tanakh? David HaMelech, very good. So it's hard to believe that the great David HaMelech will come from a relationship that was fully made in sin. So we,
plus the son he wanted to protect was still alive, right?
Yes. Sheila. I forgot how to pronounce the exact pronunciation of it, but I think that's his name. Sheila. Yeah.
So like
he's alive, yes.
So where is he? Where when all this is?
So what happens basically, he's in Cheder. I don't know. You kind of figure out where he is. He's in school. But he's like basically a young kid. It's Tamar thinks that, okay, I'm going to wait till he comes of age and then I'll marry him. But then she realizes when he comes of age and nothing's happening, he's not being offered to her. She gets the message and it takes matters into her own hands.
Did he not think that she was Jewish?
Very good. So Dina's like, maybe she was not Jewish. So listen to this. Next time I'll try to print it out with the translation, but I'll translate for you. Second paragraph. Listen to this fascinating conversation. Do you ever wonder how the conversation went? Pay certain for services and then that's it. The Gemara and Sota, the rabbis, fill in the details.
Look, how did they know?
That's always the question. So the easiest answer for it, there's two answers. Either rabbis had a tradition, or alternatively, it's what I'll call in, I apologize, irreverent terms, as a conservative rabbi once put it to me, the rabbi's fan fiction on Tanakh. But it's a fan fiction. But unlike fan fiction, which of course is just like you make up whatever you want, the rabbis understood that they were filling in the blanks that God deliberately left so that they could convey a Torah value through that lesson. That's usually the easiest way to understand Medrash, because Medrash makes all sorts, if you take it literally, Medrash makes all sorts of fantastic claims that are very difficult for one to swallow, especially those of us who are more of the rationalist inclination. So that's how I would understand it. But what did Rabbi Sion listen to this conversation? Second paragraph. Indeed, this is what happened. Yehuda shows Tamar. Yehuda, before he hired her, Yehuda asked her a few questions. He really didn't want to do this, actually. He was trying to find a reason to tell himself that it was usser. And in fact, he made sure, he interrogated her to ensure that it was mutter for him to have relations with her. How so? He asked, Shemer Nachrasat, maybe you're not Jewish, whatever, not Jewish really means back then. Amrolei, Giyorza Nishi says, no, I'm a convert, I'm fully Jewish. Chazar Yehuda Vashal, Yehuda tries another question. Maybe I can't have relations with her, why? Shema Eishas Ishat, maybe you're a married woman. Amrolei, no, Penuyani, no, I'm not married, I'm available. Chazar Vashal, Yehuda tries a third time another question. Shema Kivel Bach Avich Kiddushin. maybe your father accepted kiddushin on your behalf a long time ago, and you don't. Perhaps you're married to someone that you never got divorced from. Like, you have to say it that way because a woman, when she becomes a bogeris after 12 and a half years old, her father no longer has any jurisdiction over her. So that's how you have to understand it. Amar lei, no, yisomani. I never had a, and my father died, you know.
I'm an orphan.
Yeah, I'm an orphan. So I never really had a father, but didn't have functionally a father. So he says, Shema tzmea at nida. Maybe you're a nida, and I'll have relations with you. Amar lei, tahora. And she said, no, I went to mikvah, and I am tahora, which, by the way, just a quick parenthetical. I think this was like a movement in the, I only know from what I hear, I never looked at the Upper West Side, but basically a lot of singles who are more sexually frustrated. So they want to find ways to have intimacy, but without outright breaking halacha. So the idea they came up with was, they call it a tefillin date. That's the term. That reason it's called a tefillin date is because the girl goes to mikvah, and then the guy comes over. They do what they do together, and then he's there the next morning and puts on tefillin for Shabbos. So that's why it's called a tefillin date. This is a
why is that legit? Why is that okay?
So it's right. So they think it's okay. Why? Because she went to mikvah, so there's no iser nida, right? But what they forgot apparently was the iser of lo siya kedesha, which people don't think about as much. That there is an iser. The Rambam writes to have relations outside the context of marriage. So
but how can they go to the mikvah if they're not married? I mean,
because the mikvah, some mikvahs don't ask questions. I mean, I don't know how ours operates. I don't think they have someone at the door who like IDs people. Show me your wedding ring.
Okay, make an appointment. So
well, before you get married,
you do. But then throughout marriage, also is ideally what's supposed to be happening. So obviously, postmenopausal, you don't. Anyway,
what's odd is it seems as though halacha is struggling, and this is such a not known concept in halacha, and yet in the secular society, you know, talking about having sexual relations out of wedlock was always a no-no.
That was the term I was looking for, wedlock.
I mean, that was like common. I mean, maybe not so much today anymore, but certainly when I was growing up, I was like, oh no, you don't do that. And it didn't even have a religious connotation necessarily. It was just
society. So Toby said, like, society knew back in the day. We never had to talk about the Israel Sea of Asia because society knew back then that you're not intimate with someone who you're not married to. Society just knew that. And remember when we went through that Shula of Rav Asher Weiss last week? He said, we're like Sodom and Amorah. That now, because remember he was asking that question that, well, isn't there a chazakah? That ain adam osa bilasu bilas nos, that when two people have relations together, they intend for marital purposes. He says that chazaka is out the window because, you know, haraya, we see right in front of us that people dafka live together as boyfriend and girlfriend, specifically not getting married. That's like a stage in the relationship. So, yeah, it's that's maybe why it's the Isser Lo Siya Kedesha, Toby points out, has never been on our collective
so
radar.
Do you see this? I mean, sociologically, do we see this in the Orthodox world now that men, the unmarried men and women live together?
Oh, I mean, I can't say I've like witnessed with my own two eyes, but you see it a lot.
In the Orthodox world?
Yeah.
It's,
I know, I mean, Marissa had, you see, I grew up in where she was world, but Marissa, who grew up in my Orthodox world, she like named me a lot of people who ducks.
You
don't
have to name,
of course. No. It's one that came to mind. I'm going to say your note. I'm not going to mention any names. This is something that happens. In fact, you know who's a good article to read if you want to read about it? My Rebbe, Rabbi Ezra Schwartz, who was the previous rabbi of Mount Sinai, Washington Heights. That is a singles shul. So he did a very smart thing. He waited until he finished his job there. And then he published his article in Tablet about his experiences of being a rabbi in a single school. He clearly had that article ready to go, but like was waiting till he was out of there. And I remember it was Nido. And he would actually share with us the struggles that he saw and how he tried to counsel people with like no easy answer to someone who's over 30 years old and is still trying to find someone. I mean, you look in Pirkei Avos, Chazal thought we were married when we were teenagers, you know? So it's, they probably understood the human condition to a certain degree. Excuse me. Anyway, but yes, this is very much, very much happy. Go watch Shining Sea. Go to the Upper West Side. This is my typical, you know, it happens. Okay. So with that in mind, you see that Yehuda was actually making sure, you know, like he did all the drishos v'chakiros. He interrogated her to make sure, you know, that you're not a non-Jew, you're not a nida, you're not married. And after he went through his entire checklist, he's like, oh, okay, kosher, let's do this. But however, for Amar Akach Haram Keich of Keich Avar Yehuda Alav Dekatsha. So the question is, why, if he was worried about all these other possible violations of the Torah, why wasn't he worried about the Isser of Lo Siyah Kedesha, of, again, for lack of a better term, prostitution, but really relations out of wedlock? So the Maharsha, so the answer is that Yehuda actually did, he actually was Mekadesher with money, and with a document, with kesem and shtar, which are two modes that we marry someone with. You think about under the chuppah, when you give the ring, that's kesem, that's money. And some say when you hand the ksuba over, the groom hands the ksuba over to the bride, that is giving a shtar to effectuate kiddushin. Excuse me. So the Marsha and Sota on the spot there writes, Heir al dvar shei hare Yehuda amar l're'ehu hadulami, shetamar tikach la esa irvum, So number one, we have two questions over here. One will resolve, one we won't resolve so well, I think. One is, if he actually did marry her, and he, you know, she wasn't an Anita, she wasn't a guy, et cetera, et cetera. This is all kosher, glot kosher, mahadrin and mahadrin. So why is Yehuda feel this busha? Why is it clear from the psukim that he has a shame in what he did? What he did was completely legitimate, according to this. That's question number one.
Father-in-law.
What?
Jane was abandoning his wife. I mean, if he married her, huh. You could have multiple wives.
Oh, we don't know about.
You could have multiple wives.
That is
right,
true.
But she was essentially abandoned.
Do we know if she's still alive? So they're asking about, well, Yehuda should feel ashamed about just getting his second wife or leaving his wife for Tamar. I don't know if we know anything about Yehuda, right? Because presumably he had a wife. That's how he had children, right? But we don't, as far as I know, I don't think we even hear about it. Which, by the way, that's a great question. Like, look who's missing from the story over here. Mrs. Yehuda. What happened to Mrs. Yehuda? So that's, I would say her name. I just don't know her name. That's the issue.
Wasn't there more than one? I don't know.
Right. So that's what, right. And Dina pointed out, you can have multiple wives.
I think the Busha is like the father-in-law.
You're saying, so Dina suggests the Busha is, you know, you should feel bad because you're the father-in-law.
Aren't you not supposed to, like, alot ervat?
Right, avicha.
Yeah.
But this is interesting. This is the opposite because it's...
There must be something in the list.
Yeah.
Let's go down Achrimos. You'll find something and you'll throw in a few sets of malchus while we're at it. Okay, so, and the second question is, oh, hikshashari maises ahoya below Adam. Wait a minute. Remember, we spent the whole last 2 weeks ago. We talked about what's one of the issue reasons the kedusha might not be valid, because a conservative rabbi and all the people there aren't kosher witnesses. Remember, an indispensable component of effectuating a kedushin is having two valid witnesses. Yehuda goes to Tamar and secretly, I mean, you could argue they were in the crossroads, actually. There could have been two witnesses walking by, possibly. But there were no two witnesses that witnessed this kedushin, as far as we know. So how can we accept that this was a kedushin? And if there isn't a valid kedushin here, then we run back to the same issue. Yehuda, who was so careful about making sure she was a Jew, making sure she wasn't married, making sure she wasn't a nida, somehow he forgot about this law of losia kedesha, of not having relations outside the context of marriage. So that's the question. Where are the Adam over here? Any suggestions? What do we do?
Maybe he was kind of pushed into it. It wasn't his desire to do it. It was Dina's desire.
It was who's?
Tamar's desire.
Tamar's desire. But you see that I'm gonna get very liberal on you right now. You're gonna blame this on Tamar? You're saying Yehuda had no agency? You're saying this is all the woman's fault?
in this particular case, maybe she maybe she knew what the future was supposed to be.
Ah, okay, very good. So there is a discussion about that. You want to hear something even more wild, by the way. There is a Medrash. I saw it quoted in the Sivos Shalom, which is a Hasidic Sefer. And basically, because this is a question, like this bothers a lot of people, by the way. How could the Halig Yehuda, the great Tzaddik Yehuda, hire a prostitute? Like, even if you say maybe like possibly this Mutter and some great Yehuda Tzaddik could do that. You know, like this is where the Malchus based David comes from. This is where the line of Jewish kings come from. This is where Mashiach comes from. He was right. He was very distraught. This after the whole Yosef case, he's fallen from grace. True. But still, like, so, but the Hasidim, especially, you know, especially like, though, you know, us modern Orthodox people were fine being somewhat critical of characters in the Torah. But if they come from like a Hasidish, very traditional perspective, Hasidic and traditional doesn't always go together, really, because that's a recent movement. But you know what I mean? That like the Avos were perfect, pristine. They're like not even human beings, they were angels. So how can Yehuda sin? So you know what they suggest based on a Medrash? I need to track it down. That actually God needed Yehuda and Tamar to produce a child. And so Yehuda, for lack of a better term, was possessed by a divine will, which forced him to have relations with Tamar, and it was not his own free choice. He was, you know, like, you talk about a lack of free will. This is literally, you know how we have questions maybe about Paro, his heart was hardened, and we try to find ways to argue, like, his heart wasn't really hardened, God just made it, put him in a scenario where he would be set to fail. We come up with different ideas. This matters outright, literally says, Yehuda's body was hijacked. And it was forced to do what he needed to do.
I mean, there are lots of examples in Tanakh about good things coming out of illicit relationships, like David and Bathsheba. And you got Solomon. I mean, there's no way that anyone can say that,
right,
you know, that was an appropriate relationship at the time it happened. But I guess the ultimate result, you know, justified whatever was done. So why don't I just say that here?
Maybe our heroes aren't as perfect as we're.
Exactly.
You know, right. So I'll just repeat for the folks on the phone. So what Toby's pointing out is like, you know, why do we have to like, you know, fetch in this shot, right? Why do we have to give such a far-fetched answer that he was possessed? And I agree with you. I think it's far-fetched. That's why it's what Rav Sivalovsky, who will be our scholar in residence for Yom Ian, he calls these ideas like things that you don't really use in practice or preach from the pulpit per se, but he calls them collector's items. He's like good makoros, like to know. They're just like interesting fun facts that you drop in a shir. So the point that Toby was making, and then Zadie, I'll take your point, is that what do you mean? We see with David and Bathsheba, that was an illicit relationship. Okay, maybe technically it wasn't adultery because her husband was already dead on the front lines, but clearly it was done through an unethical means. I would say, though, the difference here is that we don't see Yehuda getting punished. There's no indication he's punished for having this relationship with Tamar versus David HaMelech actually gets rebuked and he actually admits his sin, and arguably the whole rebellion of Avshalom, it possibly is due to that sin that he committed. So here we don't see indication. Exactly. And that's what would make it, I mean, it's hard. Like, it's an absence. We're trying to prove something from an absence of something not happening.
By the way, but you see that they were married, because doesn't he actually marry her later?
At the end of the story, so they are together. But this is beforehand.
No, but I'm saying it did. Before you got to this possession one, there was the theory that you were actually married.
Right.
And I'm saying, how could that hold up if he then marries her later?
But is the wording that they get married later? What's the wording? Mm-hmm. I don't think there's like a wording that says then they got married and lived happily ever afterwards. But I have to look back. I have to do, I have to catch up on my Shania Mikra. Zadie.
Yeah. You know, the Torah, I think, goes out of its way to show us the weaknesses and the blemishes in the Avos. Matter of fact, all the, if you want to use the term, heroes in the Torah. And his blemish is being shown. It's a teaching point. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's expected to be perfect. And it's also showing the righteousness of Tamar, because she was solving a situation that was handed to her.
Right. She took initiative when things, she saw nothing was happening, and then she stood up and made things happen. Yeah, let's see that them teach that at Beis Yaakov. But Zadie, I think the point you're making is actually works well. What Toby was pointing out, that Yehuda was in a slump right now, and this really shows the vulnerability of even the greatest characters in Tanakh. And ultimately, from this, he rose and became Yehuda that he was. In fact, that's the point that many make of why ultimately did the line of kings come from Yehuda and not from, let's say, Yosef, who was the viceroy. It's because Yehuda showed us that Yosef, he remained pure the entire time. When temptation came with the wife of Potiphar, he said no. But Yehuda is like the Baal Tshuva. He actually did sin. He went down, but then he came back up. And those are the kind of leaders and models we need sometimes, not just those who were like the Gedolim and like the art scroll biographies who were perfect their entire lives, but the people like who had imperfections and then were able to overcome it. Now, you know, you don't want to go the opposite extreme. Sometimes you have like that that youth advisor guy who's like, yeah, I smoked every single drug in the book. I can name more than he smoked. And, like, we don't need to hear like everything in your past. Some people think like, I'm so relatable because I shared every single stupid thing I ever did. My time at NCSY, what can I tell you? Like, that's what you hear sometimes. It's all you hear. Okay, we have a little bit of material to cover. So if we could just hold questions for another 5 minutes, I just want to resolve this and then take any additional ideas that you have. So again, the way we're solving the issue of Losia Kadesha, let's just bring it in. The issue we had is Yehuda wants to do everything in a kosher fashion. He asked her a million questions. Are you a Jew? Are you not a Nida? Are you not married? But he didn't seem to care about being married to her, which leads some Rishon Achrom to suggest that no, in fact, they actually were married. He married her through money, through documents, Kesev Ushtar. But the question is, how did he effectuate the Kiddushin without witnesses? So where were the witnesses? So the answer, interestingly, this is a whole separate sugya, but I'll give you one answer. The Rush writes, this is on the bottom of the column going to the next one. The Shtar Kiddusha Shekasu Habal B'Ksavi Yado Kosher Af below Edei Chasima below Edei Mesira. So whole big sugya Kiddusha about, do you need witnesses to sign on a document or just witnesses when you hand over the document? Leave that to the side. Basically, there's a principle in Halacha called Hodas Bal Din Kameya Edim Dami, that my admission in court is the equivalent of 100 witnesses. What does that mean? 100 witnesses equal to 2 witnesses in halakha. What it's saying is, you're not going to get a better proof. Let's say we're in a financial case and 2 witnesses claim I owe $200. If I admit I owe $200, there's nothing better than me myself actually admitting I owe the $200. So it's a similar idea over here, that maybe if I myself am the one who writes the document for the Kiddushin and sign my name on there, I don't need 2 witnesses because it's my own admission on here that I am obligating myself to this woman. So what could be better than that? So perhaps you'd have to say that Yehuda wrote up like a whole ksuba on the spot and gave it to her. Again, this is probably not exactly how it went down, but that's the safer goes into what we call halachic acrobatics. Fun lumbus on the parsha, but this is to bring me to another point. You flip over your page, a point over here. So a question is: a lot of Rishonim don't accept that. A lot of Rishonim accept it when it comes to Gittin, but not to Kiddushin. So we need another resolution. Another resolution is that look, Tamar isn't Jewish. In fact, there's no Torah around at this point. Remember, you know, sometimes we act as if the Torah is on, sometimes we don't. We're kind of oscillating between them. But the idea is that there's no Torah around right now. And by the way, if you look in the pasuk, I put quotation marks there so you can see it, and I underlined a little bit. So the next side of the page, the second box, you'll see what I mean. See like the second box. Yeah, that one on the right bottom box. So Ukesef, I'm sorry, because of a kesef mishnah al ramach, the kushiyas lo kashem mini. Shemifurish v'torah, lo siya kedesha mibnos Yisrael. It says, who's not allowed to be kedesha? Some friends in Bnos Yisrael. There's no Yisrael yet. There's no Bnos Yisrael. There's no Jew, that means Jewish women. Shemifurish, shekola isser ino ela b'Bnos Yisrael. And came, but Nachris, Enis, or Zed, the Kadesha. Wow, that's a really great resolution. The Grizz, in the next paragraph, points out. Anyone know who the Grizz was? It's not a bear. It's not a grizzly bear. The Grizz was Revelvel Soloveitchik. So you had Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. So he had a son, Revelvel, who was the Grizz. And then he had another son, Reb Moshe, whose son was Rav Yosef Do Soloveitchik. Joseph B. Soloveitchik from YU.
Yosef was the son of Moshe Soloveitchik.
Yosef Dov is from Moshe. So basically, the Grizz is the Rav's uncle. Very good. And there's actually, I think, a few correspondences between them that we have on record. So it's talking in Torah. It's very nice. So the Grizz, I mean, this is like a name just good to know in general, like yeshiva world. Like you put a Grizz on a sheet, like, you know, that carries a lot of weight. So the Grizz writes, the Isser of Losia Kedisha, of not having relations outside the context of marriage, can only be operative when there is an option to have a Jewish marriage. But if there's no option to have a Jewish marriage at this point in history, then the Isser of Losia Kedisha is moot. It doesn't have any application because the Isser is, do not have relations outside the context of marriage. But that's only forbidden when there's an option to have a Jewish marriage. If you can't be married, then this Isser is inoperative. Achein, and therefore he says, B'nachers u'shivcha she'ein kidushin tosvehen, ein shayachach Isser Kedisha. Therefore, when it comes to a non-Jewish woman, for her, since she doesn't have the option of kiddushin, therefore there's no iser of losia kedesha for being a kedesha. Ukmoshavir agriz matakodim matan Torah in iser kedesha. Asher dechozmanch in ishus Yisrael in mitpas kol ikar kalos shem kedesha. That's what he says. Now, final paragraph, and then he puts it all together. He quotes the Mor Nevuchim. Now, the Mor Nevuchim, the guy from Perplex, that's the Rambam. The Mor Nevuchim does not usually get cited in the Sefer, by the way, because this is a halachic Sefer. So he doesn't always quote from philosophical texts. But listen to that. I never saw this point in the Mor Nevuchim before. I can't say I didn't go through the Mor Nevuchim as a whole book, but I've seen a lot of key passages from there. And I never saw this one. Listen to this. This is fascinating. Very, very, it's almost like progressive in a certain way. Shabiyas HaKadesha Koda Matan Torah Kabiyas HaAdama Ishto Acher Matan Torah. Rambam writes that one's relations with a Kadesha before the giving of the Torah is tantamount, it's equivalent to the relationship that a man has with his wife after the Torah was given and applicable. Klomar, what does that mean? Shumaisa HaMutar She'ibo Tiyav Klav. The same way we legitimize relationships through marriage after the Torah is given, a man and woman getting together before marriage without kiddushin was also acceptable. Just acceptable as two people being married today. And listen to this line. This is the kicker where I double underlined it. Umatan haskar hamuskam olav lekidesha oz kematan tsubas isha la ata bisman hagirishin. The money that's given to a woman to a prostitute before Matan Torah is basically the equivalent of what a man has to give to a woman when he divorces her for her services. You guys catch that?
Don't get that exactly.
So basically what he's saying, this is like a crazy notion, by the way. Forgive me, Rambam, for saying this, but the Mor Nevuchim is full of things like this. Basically, the money that a person gives to a prostitute is to reimburse her for her, it's what?
No wonder he was perplexed.
For
what?
So, I'll just explain why this is perplexing. Not everyone caught on to that. So the reason this is perplexing, very good, Toby, is because he says that the money given to compensate the prostitute for her times before Kiddushin is equivalent to the money that a man, if he chooses to divorce his wife, must give her at the end of a marriage to compensate her for her services, like the prostitute. Because this is an obligation he has that's incumbent upon him to reimburse her for her her time. Maybe there's more to this. He's taking a line out of context here. Maybe it would sound different if we read it in the broader context in the Mordechai, possibly.
It makes sense.
You just said it was perplexing. Now you said it makes sense.
I'm thinking the concept is that there's got to be payment for services at some point. Before Matzan Torah, it was like he paid in advance, and after Matzan Torah, he paid at the end.
Yes, conceptually, the toy points out, yes, conceptually it makes sense. Meaning, yes, you are giving money for something that was provided to you. It's a trade in that respect. But the part that's unsettling is that it puts the marriage in very transactional terms, which, again, you learn Sefer Kiddushin, it's all transactional terms. But, you know, even I'll just say for myself, even after learning Kiddushin B'Iyan more than once, I was still thrown off by this line over here. Because what happens? A lot of the Rishonim, what they'll do is that they might explain that even though it's in transactional terms, it's not really a monetary transaction, right? We try to smooth things over. But here, Rambam just like plows into that. He digs deeper into that idea. He's like, yes, it's a transaction. Your wife is basically a prostitute and you're compensating her for her time. That's what it sounds like, what he's writing over there. That's what's, again, admittedly, I did not look up the reference over here. I only have his quote. Maybe there's more to what the Rambam is writing. I freely admit that I haven't looked up the full context of this Rambam.
Because there was no intent on the part of either one of them to be married. It was just purchasing her services for one experience. And he agreed to pay a certain price for it in advance. And then he sent somebody back with the payment and he couldn't find Tamar.
Right. But the crazy part is comparing a marriage to prostitution, which, by the way, I think some people who are of like a more radical feminist ideology, like that's actually what they argue, is that marriage is slavery and it's likened to prostitution. So I guess Rambam, who's, by the way, the same Rambam who says a woman shall leave her house more than like once or twice a month, is the same Rambam who, it's like a horseshoe theory, you know, if you go too far to either extreme, you wind up saying the same thing. It's like, you know, it's like anti-Semitism, you know, you go too far to right or left, you wind up both hating the Jews. So it's almost like, you know, you go too far to either extreme, you wind up saying the same thing eventually. So Klomar, she's a schus miskus a isha shemutal of l'shamo, akan dvarav, he named a furish medivrei ha-rambam, shal hayashim tiyuv kaba maise Yehuda. Therefore, everything was okay with Yehuda. The answer is, you know what? Look, we're throwing out the idea. Yehuda didn't all of a sudden write a ksubav on the spot. We don't have to get into the question of the Edom. Yehuda didn't need to marry her. And you don't have to worry about marriage happening later, Toby. They didn't have to get married because before Matan Torah, it was okay. Now, the issue that this leaves me with is this only resolves one question. This resolves how it was mutter for them to have relations with each other, but doesn't resolve the first question we had, which is, if so, why is Yehuda ashamed? Why is he busha? We just took pains to explain how it was 100% permissible what he did, that what they did together.
If it was with any other woman, it would have explained it perfectly. The fact that she was his daughter-in-law.
Right.
The busha.
As you're saying, that's his daughter-in-law. So Afal Pi Kein, even if you find a way to make him mutter, it's what we call Menuvel Bersha Satora, that it's still something that would be abominable. And something that shouldn't be done. So when he realized afterwards what happened, that's why he maybe had the busha. But the question is, did he realize at that time? He seems to have busha before realizing that it was his daughter-in-law. So it might need another explanation. I would agree. But it seems chronologically that he had busha, he had shame before finding that out. So that's the question.
When he said that she is more righteous than me, it's an acknowledgement that she was fulfilling the obligation to have a child from the family. If she couldn't get it from the youngest son, she was going to have the child by the son's father, and he was just looking for a commercial transaction to relieve his sexual tensions, and so she was more righteous than him in his estimate.
She had loftier goals, whereas he did not.
Yeah,
that's true. And by the way, just a reminder, where did we see this story happen recently in one of our shiurim that we had, other than our Monday night class that we just had? Where did this come up recently?
It must have been Thursday.
Very good. Good stuff. Yes, in our Mako shiur, remember we talked about there were three instances where God showed up to a court case where God made a bas kol come out from heaven? So we asked in our Mako's class, Chaf Gimel Amid Beis, we're almost at the end. So the question is, how did Yehuda know that she was pregnant from him? If she was a prostitute, presumably there were other men as well. So therefore, God had to intervene and tell everyone or tell him that indeed it was from him. And that's when he responds as, she's correct. She's more righteous than me.
But he was also told that she wasn't a prostitute.
So
he knew that she was not a prostitute at the,
I guess he pieced it together. I mean, for all he knows.
No, it says in the Torah that they told him that the woman wasn't there. They went to look for her and she wasn't there.
She could have set up shop somewhere else. Yeah, I mean, it's like you sell drugs in one place, you find it in a different place the next time.
Well,
maybe we could deduce something from there, Phyllis. Very good. All right. I hope we enjoyed our topic. I'll try to get translations next time. But And Zadie, I'll give you a call in 2 minutes.
Okay.
All right. Great. Take care and have a wonderful show.
Thank you very much. You too. Good. Happy.
Well, I'm saying good shots because this is my last year for the week. Okay. All right. Happy Thanksgiving.
Good vacation.